Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. And always excited to have Lisa Gibbons back on the show. We had such a fantastic conversation last time. She's promoting a big event coming up, a webinar. So I thought, hey, let's go and talk to Lisa and see how she's doing. So Lisa, how are you?
I'm doing really great. I had a nice time talking to you before as well. So thanks for having me back on.
Well, absolutely. And as we know, all our times are moving and shaking. You got a lot of things going on, especially the success of the book. Now New York Times bestselling author. I forgot to add that to your title in many, many ways. But really what's making you excited about is tomorrow, especially it'll air on all the syndication tomorrow, promoting, I guess, that day. So tell us a little bit about the webinar.
I've been really blessed to be part of a project called Conversations in Caregiving. And we've been doing these webinars that are open to anybody. They're free events that happen online. You just sign up and actually participate at alzheimersdisease.com. And they're designed really to help answer your questions, give you support, give you access to experts and people who can help you navigate a really difficult time. You know, if you love someone who has Alzheimer's disease, if you are someone who has questions about it, if you're kind of struggling with, is this dementia, is it Alzheimer's, I'm worried about myself or someone in my family, this is the place that you want to be. And the great thing is you can enter your questions and we'll get them answered to the best that we can. You can also just go on the site and see the previous conversations in caregiving. We've done a couple of these before. You can go back and watch those. And this one will also be live and also be archived at the site. It's just a great place to offer strength and support for people who are dealing with this thief of memories. And I know that's millions and millions of people.
Oh, absolutely. And doing this, you really see specifically what your organization and the organizations you're teaming up with have been able to help families through these hard times, right? And having this opportunity to be able to ask questions and learn more is so important, isn't it?
Well, this is all for family caregivers. You know, these are the people that I call the family first responders. You know, these are the husbands and the wives and the sons and the daughters, and in many cases, the friends who are showing up every day for duty. And sometimes it's pretty tough duty, and it can be isolating, and it can be sometimes really difficult because it's, you know, when someone has Alzheimer's, they can't always tell you that you're making it better. They can't always tell you what's wrong. So for caregivers, sometimes it can be like wandering through a bit of a maze. And it really does help to reach out and hold hands with others who've walked the path before. But it's funny, Neil, because our first instinct, mine was, when my mom first got diagnosed, and my mom and my grandmom both died of this disease, and I did what I think most people do, I denied. I was like, you know what? Mom's too strong. She's my rock. She's my anchor. Maybe she's just drinking too much. You know, maybe she's just repeating herself because she's bored. I just pulled the covers up over my head and didn't want to see it. And that's normal because, you get kind of numb not wanting to look at the painful reality. But the real deal is the sooner you can name it and claim it, the more powerful you're going to be.
Absolutely. And getting them through this maze is so difficult because could you imagine your loved one forgetting everything of the memories? It's so painful. And in a way, you have to kind of really let that person who's suffering not know that you're so hurt by it because it'll become worse and worse in the relationship and how to take care of them to remember that those memories are lost in ways. And that ways to remind them, even for a second, is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, that's part of what we're going to talk about at the live event, which, again, is happening on Tuesday at 8 o'clock Eastern time. And you can just you know, you can sign up right now at alzheimersdisease.com. You can join us at any time. You can go to the site at any time. It's just a free supportive site offering, so, you know, empowering educational services for caregivers. That's what we're for. But at the webinar, you're exactly right. What we'll be talking about is, you know, things to do to redirect behaviors, activities, ways to manage behaviors. One of our experts will be Dr. Gary Small, who's one of the authorities and professors at UCLA, and he's a well-known leader in this field. And he's going to offer some of the insights that he has and things that have been proven to work well. Because, you know, families need, you know, we don't have time. We don't have, we run out of patience. We run out of time. We run out of money. I always say this disease bankrupts spiritually and emotionally and financially. And, you know, you get to the end of your rope and then you're expected to keep hanging on. Well, you know, you can only tie a knot and hang on for so long by yourself. You know, you need somebody to be in the life raft with you. And so that's what my, as you know, because we've talked about it before, you and I, that's what my work has been all about with our nonprofit at Lisa's Care Connection. You know, that's what we've tried to do is help encourage families, you know, give them ways to summon their strength and to call on their courage so they can be empowered in this journey and not be overwhelmed by it. It's very easy just to say, okay, this is not the life I ordered. This is not what I thought was going to happen in my happily ever after. And it's easy to get resentful. It's understandable that you're going to be angry about that. But as soon as you can say, okay, I'm going to walk off this stage and I'm going to embrace and try. I can't rewrite the beginning, but I can say, what, you know, what can I do right now to hit the reset button? And how can I reframe this experience to make it as good as I can from here on out? You know, what can I do to write this chapter and create a new ending? Because the beginning, I don't get to go back there. I can only start from here.
And how, I'm sure through this webinar, you're going to really kind of explain to families out there how to keep that, I guess, to kind of jog the memory, even they're losing their memory, to make sure that they're treated well. They're treated with respect. It's not like they're a child. And Lisa, I know you've heard about this all the time where so many caregivers, because they just don't understand what's happening to their mom or their grandmother or their grandfather or their father, how they treat them, they kind of say, oh, well, now I guess they're just a child again. They don't remember things. And that's not the way to treat them, is it?
Well, certainly there's a dignity issue that is, and a respect issue that really does need to be honored. But there's a communication that has changed. And the way to communicate may be foreign to us because it's not necessarily on the same cognitive level that we're used to. But what you're talking about is exactly right. You know, there is dignity that they do get embarrassed. And this, you know, a heart never forgets. And we are, as caregivers, we're responsible for what we bring into the room and what we bring to a relationship. And, you know, and we have to meet our loved one where they are in the disease state because they can't join us in our state. So it's up to us to figure out, okay, how do we understand what they're trying to communicate to us? You know, maybe this means, you know, when they're saying, if they're at an assisted living facility and they're saying, I want to go home, or if they're in your living room and they're saying, I want to go home, and you're saying, but you are home, rather than trying to convince them you're home, mom, but you're home, trying to figure out, you know, what do you love about your home, mom? Tell me about home. And if you ask, tell me about home, your mom is probably really trying to say, I want to feel safe, I want to feel loved, I want to feel connected. It doesn't mean anything about wanting to go to a physical place. It may mean that she's feeling scared. So if you can kind of come up with different questions and figure out what they're saying, then you can preserve that dignity and find a way to not speak down and belittle the person. But you're exactly right.
And it's something I noticed from my great-grandmother before, and also my grandmother, that you make the mistake to understand, they don't really get what we're talking about. Well, you don't treat them so with disrespect. You don't treat them like, what are they talking about? Because there are things they still remember. There are things, and again, their short-term memory has not been, am I correct, has not been lost. It's more the long-term memory, correct?
Often that is the case, and, you know, each case will be unique. But we found that some strategies that work, I talk about the power of the white lie. For example, you know, driving is a big thing for many Alzheimer's patients. It represents independence, as it does for all of us. And but it's not safe many times for them to drive when they are disoriented and they can't get behind the wheel. So my mother would say, you know, I want to drive. And we found this to be a big struggle with her. And rather than fight with her about what she could not do, we would give her the keys and we would say, okay, Mom, well, the car's in the garage. And she would go take her purse and, you know, do all of her routine to get into the car, get her routine of getting her hair ready and, you know, everything all packed up to go. And then she would put the key in the ignition and the car wouldn't start because we had disabled the battery. And she would come in and say, something's wrong with the car. And we'd go, oh, you know what, we'll call somebody to come look at it. And then she would forget that the car was broken.
Oh, my goodness.
And the next time she would say, I want to go, I want to drive, we would say, okay, Mom, you can drive. And she would have the same process. So we would never have to tell her she couldn't drive. And it was interesting because the same with, she wanted to smoke cigarettes. And we finally realized we could give her the cigarettes, we just didn't give her a lighter. So she walked around with a cigarette that wasn't lit all day long. She was very happy.
So,
little things that you learn to do to preserve what they want and what you need to do to keep their safety.
So you want to be creative in a lot of ways. And through this process and learning more from experts like yourself that have become through different things, that you got to make sure that it's still a situation. When we deal with our children in certain ways, we don't want to let them down, even if they really don't understand. You think of a 2-, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, and they throw that temper tantrum. You don't want to belittle them because then they're going to remember that. However, and then they're going to be hurt by this. So you don't want a scene, and you're able to still, she has that idea. She's going to go smoke that cigarette or she's going to jump in that car, and it changes the thought process. So she has, thinks she's still in control. Because as my mom talks about all the time with my grandmother, that, it, again, being a child, it can become very draining for the caregiver in a way, too.
You know, the process of caring creates such compassion fatigue that often it starts the clock on subtracting 10 years from the life of the caregiver. That's how serious it is with the stress. So while you're trying to save the life and add years to the life of your loved one, you can, in fact, be subtracting years from your life. And that's why I wrote a book called Take Your Oxygen First. And this is the best advice I can give any caregiver, is before you look after anybody else, it's imperative. The most loving thing you can do is to nourish yourself. And, you know, otherwise you are oftentimes failing faster than they are. And that's just the real story.
Wow. And that makes sense because I guess the caregivers get really drained out as well. I mean, as parents, we all know we get drained. And just imagine if you're older and you're dealing with this kind of stress and it hurts you because the caregiver feels very hurt, right? Oh, Mom doesn't remember.
Well, and there's,
go ahead.
Yes. And guilt, you know, guilt is your constant companion. And, you know, when we feel powerless, that's a very difficult place to be. And that's why we come up with these experts that can give you tips and strategies and insights. We have words of wisdom from, you know, real people, you know, just like people listening to us right now, family members who are going through this at AlzheimersDisease.com, who talk about what worked for them. And I loved advice from one woman who mentioned going grocery shopping with her dad who had Alzheimer's disease. And she said that she talked to the store manager. She would get a cart and do her family shopping. She would give her dad a cart. He wanted to be productive. She had a hard time keeping up with him while she had to run the errand. So he had his own list. He would go through and put things in his cart. When they were checking out, the manager knew that the items in dad's cart were not to be checked out. They were going to reshelve those items and restock them. But Dad felt very proud that he had shopped, he contributed to the family, he had participated, and everybody was happy. And I think that's such a lovely, creative way that you can elicit your community. My dad used to take my mother with Alzheimer's out to dinner, and he had a little card that he would give the maitre d' or the hostess or the server that said, please be patient. My wife has a memory problem. And so that when she started acting inappropriately, which she often would, they would understand, and they would just kind of all be in on it together. And those are just little things that, make your life, make you less lonely and give you more of a team approach to managing.
What is your hope from this webinar? What do you want to see people who do go to the website and, register and participate in this learn from? What is your ultimate goal?
I want people to feel that they have techniques, strategies, options, empowered, that they feel like they can do it, that they can not only survive, but they can thrive. You know, that they're going to be okay, that they're not alone, that it may seem so overwhelming and such a difficult burden, that's such a tough hand that they've been dealt. But they get to figure out how to play it, and that we've got people available to help. And that's really all it is. You know, there's something about a community, and that's all this is. AlzheimersDisease.com is just a community by caregivers, for caregivers, about caregivers. There's something about knowing that you belong with other people who really see you, who know what your journey is about, that feels very safe. And that's what I hope. That's my highest hope.
Well, it definitely seems like your highest hope, and I know it's going to be definitely a success. For people, and one thing that's so amazing, Lisa, about having a nationally syndicated talk show, especially with the archives that stations keep playing over and over again, if they did miss this webinar, is there going to be an opportunity to re-listen to that again after the event takes place, or are there going to be more opportunities for them to get some of that information?
At any time, if you go to AlzheimersDisease.com, you can find all of our conversations in caregiving archived at the site, and you can participate. Just, it's a free community just to join or just to browse. Just, you know, if you're surfing the web and it's the middle of the night and you're just concerned or worried or lonely or curious, put through to AlzheimersDisease.com and you'll find supportive information. You'll be able to see our archived conversations in caregiving. I just hope it feels like a blanket of support for people.
Well, absolutely, Lisa. And this is one of the things I'm going to call out all my syndicated networks out there to make sure that they feature this as a major feature, because you're taking your time to come out and be on the show and really to promote it themselves on these radio stations and continue to promote your organization and webinars like this one, because I mean, all of us are going to have to deal with this someday. All of us are going to have that that situation where a loved one's going to forget and how hurtful it's going to be. And to learn from these strategies and tidbits and things that your experts are able to bring to the table, and I consider you an expert as well after talking to you two times about what you firsthand have gone through with a family member, that ultimately we all need to check this out and listen more to these strategies. So, Lisa, first of all, again, which website again for that information and to listen
Alzheimer's Disease.com is our website. It's a free website, and our webinar is live at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night Eastern Time.
And also, I wanted to ask Lisa, the success of your book, where can we purchase your book? I'm sure you're excited about that, because it's kind of funny. We thought the second time you come on to talk about your book, but we'll have to set that up for another time. But I'm sure you're extremely excited about the success of your book and being a New York Times bestseller, isn't it? It must be great.
I was so jazzed to make the New York Times bestseller list, and I think it really speaks to the fact that there are a lot of people who want to, need to, or have to reinvent their lives. You know, Take Two was all about hitting the reset button on your life to create your own happy ending or new beginning. And it was really exciting for me to hear so many stories about how people did it. You know, they got fired and they started over. They got divorced and they were able to reset their lives. You know, they gained weight or they lost confidence, whatever it was, you know, to have that realization that, oh my gosh, I can give myself permission to begin again. And then to hear the stories of rebuilding and coming back stronger and brighter than ever before, it's just really, really the coolest thing. That's why I wrote the book, and that to me is just the most nurturing experience to connect, to be able to connect to people who have found value in that. I can't even tell you the biggest smile it puts on my face. I've had the best time with it.
Well, absolutely, Lisa, and it must make you really smile because, again, it's going to help so many people and the process of what you'll be able to do. But I know we can find all that information, purchase your book, and learn about all what you're doing with your TV show and all these things at your website. What is your website?
LisaGibbons.com. You can find out about the book there. We now have the book. The audio book is available, so that's interesting. The first time I have done an audio book, because I did the audio version myself, which I really enjoyed. A lot of people asked me for it, so we did that. So it's available for Kindle, for audio download. You can get it at Amazon, Books a Million, and everywhere else. So that's take two.
Okay, fantastic. And you can follow yourself on Twitter as well, and you have a Facebook fan page as well, correct?
I would love it if everybody could become part of our community. I'm at Lisa Gibbons on Twitter, and please do check out my Facebook page and leave me a comment. Tell me you heard the show, and let's connect. That would be absolutely lovely.
Well, fantastic, Lisa. We'll have to have you back on in a quarter and to kind of tell us what happened at your last event and help promote your next one. So thanks again for calling.
My pleasure. Always fun to talk to you. I really appreciate the support, too.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Lisa.
Okay. Till next time.
All right. Take care. Okay. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And I really enjoy interviewing NBA players because I was a former college basketball player myself, and absolutely, he's had a fantastic career in the NBA and look forward to learning more about that and his great foundation. So I want to welcome the program, former NBA star Adonel Foyle. Adonel, thanks for calling.
The pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, fantastic. I'm excited to talk to you, especially about, I guess, first of all, your career in basketball, basically how you got involved in basketball, and then the giving back portion for these two segments. Because, Adonel, what I see completely from just reading some of the stuff before our interview, I was amazed at all the work you're doing. But I guess it starts back to how you got involved in basketball, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I grew up in an island called Canawan in St. Vincent and Grenadines. We had a population of probably about maybe 500-600 people. And after a few years there, I decided that I wanted to move on to primary school and high school. So I went over to Union Island, which they had basketball there. Basketball was brought by a soldier who fought with the Americans, and he brought back basketball because they played on the ship all the time. And the basketball in Union Island was huge. And I was 6'7", 6'8". And so my first day in high school, the guys was like, "You have to play basketball." I'm like, "What is basketball?" And they're like, "No, you have to play." And they began to bug me for weeks and weeks and weeks to play. So I finally played, made a fool out of myself, grabbed the ball, run the full length of the court, forgot to dribble. And, you know, so I like, okay, that's the end of it. It's done. It's over. I don't have to worry about it anymore. And I had one of the local guys. They're like, "I'll teach you how to play." And he started to teach me, and before long, I made the school team, and before long, I made one of the local club team. I went to a tournament, and I met two college professors who gave me the opportunity to come back to the United States and use my mediocre basketball skills to get an education. And I came to the United States, and the rest is history.
Well, and I want to get into that because, Adonel, you're saying you were not definitely an NBA-type caliber player, especially before you went to college then, it sounds like. You were...
No, because I was just learning the game. I was 15 years old. I got couldn't leave start for basketball. And I just thought that, you know, I will get a college education and I will probably go back home. And at least I'll be the first person in my family to graduate college. So I was excited just for the fact to play. And when I came to the States, my first year in high school, you know, I did very well. And everybody started saying, you know, definitely you could be recruited by almost any Division I college. And so then, you know, I was like, okay, you know, this is kind of fun. So I continued to play and continued to learn, playing AAU ball, playing high school, playing everything. And I got an opportunity to basically attend any college that I wanted in the United States, full ride basketball sports. And so I wanted to go to a school that was going to both treat me as a student and as an athlete. And, you know, I chose Colgate over the many, many great schools out there. And during my junior year, I was told that, you know, I had an opportunity to be in the NBA and play professional basketball. So it was not the plan, but it was, I think, a testament to the work and to my love for my growing love for the sport.
So you must have been pretty good at school, first of all, even though, I mean, you got a college basketball scholarship, but Colgate's not the easiest school to go to, is it?
Yeah, and I, you know, what I really wanted, I wanted to, when I go into the classroom, I wanted to be the best in the classroom, and I wanted to be the best in the basketball court, and I wanted all of it. I thought that, you know, being a student athlete means something, and that means you have to do both. And Colgate, it didn't matter whether you score 40 points, when you go into class the next morning, it's like, where's my paper? And I wanted that difficult academic environment because, you know, I knew that I might be in the NBA, but nobody knows, nobody could guarantee that. But an education is for a lifetime. So I wanted to make sure that I get a good opportunity to have both, to have the best of both worlds. And so when the opportunity came to be in the NBA, I was ecstatic. So I came out my junior year, and, you know, I went back to Berkeley out in California. I got drafted by Golden State, 8 overall, and then I went back to school here and finished my undergraduate and graduated from Colgate magna cum laude. So I felt like I had the best of both worlds in college, and I got an opportunity to play at the highest level in basketball.
And that's tremendous. And so academics was important. And see, I told you, I said, telling the story about you, O'Donnell, we're going to find out why you had the foundation in our second segment, because you were definitely the kind of person that would say, I'm just going to play basketball. And you never thought you could play in the NBA. So talking about how academics was so important, when you got on the basketball floor at Colgate, they probably taught you how to play ball, right? Because, I mean, you started at 15, and I remember when I went from high school to college basketball, it was Division III, but it was just unbelievable. Everyone who was a star in high school was on the same team competing for the same position. So you really had a competition, and the fact is the level in college compared to high school is unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's important when you get to the collegiate level is, like, you are, as you say, you're one of many, many great players that are coming out of high school. And, you know, the difficult thing is that now that people are starting to exploit, you know, what you don't do well, so they put you in a situation where you're stretched. And so it was an amazing thing for me because, you know, I told my coach when I got that, I said, you know, I want to learn the game and I want to be really good at this game and I will do whatever it takes to do it. And he looked at me like I was crazy because most students don't say that to the coach. I was like, you know, I'll do whatever it takes because I want the best of both worlds. So, but it was a difficult thing to play in the Patriot League. We had some great teams there, and you know I continued to work really, really hard, and I got an opportunity to play at the next level. But collegiately, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we got to go to the dance, you know, while I was there, and it was amazing. We played Kansas. I got to go to the dance the second year. We played Connecticut. And we competed very well as a 16th seed. We got an opportunity. We were right in the game and had an opportunity to play against some of the best players in college basketball. So I felt like I was fortunate to get a little bit of a high-level basketball and still get a quality and great education.
So, and when you started playing, like they taught you to play, but then you started knowing you had some talent when you could play against, especially, I guess, in the tournament, against the top players, right? When you knew you were competing against them.
Yeah, and what was huge for me is that I continued to play AAU ball. I really learned a lot. You know, really stretched myself. I asked the coach to really try to get us to play a lot more demanding teams. So we played Syracuse, we played Stanford, we played Mississippi. We went to tournaments where a lot of the good teams were competing so that I can get the exposure of playing against the best players out there. And it was a fantastic ride. It was amazing. Because those were open where, you know, a lot of people didn't think that Colgate and the Patriots would compete. And we went out and we worked hard. And I get a chance to play some of the great players that I will come back and play with at the next level. So it was an unbelievable experience.
We're speaking to Donald Foyle, and we're talking about his basketball career, NBA, and right now we're in college, to his foundation in the next segment on TotalTutor.net on the Total Education Network, Total Education Celebrity Show / Beach Lifestyle. And, Adonal, when I'm learning about this, basically you're learning the game, you're finding out you can compete, and once you knew that you're going to go ahead and play in NBA, was it hard to go out early? You said you left in junior year. So you must have really...
It was the most difficult thing for me, I think, because I really wanted to spend all 4 years there. But one of the things that was started happening was I realized that, you know, I wasn't being stretched anymore. I wasn't being pushed as much in the Patriot League. The first, you know, three years, you know, I started to really get a grasp of the game. And then I felt like, at that point, I had kind of, from an academic standpoint, I was fine. I continued to learn. But from a basketball standpoint, I felt that I needed to be pushed at the next level. I needed to have an opportunity to play at the highest level so that I can continue to push my basketball skills. So I felt that it was one of the most difficult decisions to make, because I had committed to staying all 4 years, but I thought that was the time to move on. So I did. And, you know, I went back and, as I said, and finished my undergraduate and eventually started my master's program. So I felt like, you know, it went on the way I wanted it, which was to always have that duality between academics and sports. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I continued to develop in both areas. So the NBA was a move that I thought was necessary for my basketball career, and I did it.
And when you decided to come out junior year, was there a lot of interest, would you say, when you...
Yeah, I mean, there was. And I mean, it was difficult because I think I had broke my foot the year. I had a crack in my stiff metatarsal. And, you know, we did a lot of therapy, and I went and visited tons of team and worked out for them and really, you know, showed them what I was capable of doing. And so there was a lot of interest. And, you know, I was able to be drafted 8 overall and go into a sunny place in California, in Golden State. So coming from upstate New York as an island boy, it was like amazing to come out where there was like sun out in the Bay Area. And, you know, we had a team that went through some struggle, but to spend over 13 years in the NBA was an extraordinary gift and something that, you know, I will remember for the rest of my life.
So in the 13-year career, basically a lot of people can't last that long in the NBA, right? So that's something that you can really be proud of in your career, that you lasted 13 years.
Well, when you think of the average career is 4.7 years, and you're able to spend 13, I mean, you're doing something well. And obviously, no one gives you a job in the NBA because they like you. They give you a job because they think that you can help them win, or you can help them do something in the basketball court. So I'm fortunate that, you know, I was able to come out and play, and I play as hard as I can. I always felt that was important. I continue to learn the game. I continue to get better. I went to Pete and World Camp, even as an NBA player, almost my first 7 years. I learned a tremendous amount from him. He was one of the greatest teachers that I think I ever had, you know, going out to Hawaii. And, you know, he was an extraordinary human being, and he taught the game with such ease and love for the game. And even at 80-something, when he was out there, he was still you know, showing us the move and teaching us. And I learned so much. I continue to really view the game as an opportunity to learn and an opportunity to keep progressing and getting better.
And through that process of your career, what would you say was your highlight of your NBA career?
I would say just the longevity of it and the opportunity to play with some of the greatest players. I had a chance to play with Dwight over in Orlando. I played with, I think, you know, I played with Jason Richardson. I played with Gilbert Arenas. I played with some great guys that, you know, end up having a very amazing careers. And really learning. I mean, my first year in the league, I had Terry Cummings and Felton Spencer. And, you know, coming in as a young guy and having those kind of role models, guys that really learn how to tough it out at the league level and really learn the game and really able to adapt to the game. So I learned a lot from them, how they take care of their bodies and how they continue to really see the game. And it taught me a lot. And I was very receptive to that. And, you know, and obviously in terms of becoming one of the elite shot blockers in the NBA is something that is very difficult to do considering the caliber of players. And so I enjoy the journey of learning, of playing, of having really great friendships and having that time. And it's been in 13 years.
Okay, when we get back, more with O'Donnell Foyle, and now I want to go life after basketball, especially why the foundation and how our listeners can help out. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment. TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, and I'm with O'Donnell Foyle, and I really could talk to him hours just about his NBA career, but he's here to definitely, and you have other things as well, O'Donnell. I might have to bring you back, especially for your children's book, because you could be on a different one of my shows. You know that, because, and so we can maybe mention, we'll definitely plug it at the end, but we could talk about that as well because of my Author's Corner show, which is another very fantastic show on my network. Let's go specifically to why life after basketball, when you decided to retire. And the time came to give back in specific ways. Did you have the foundation started before then or after you retired?
Yes, I have two foundations. The first one was started my second year in the league. It's called Democracy Matters. And really we wanted to – I had a challenge when I was in college. My college professor at the time had a discussion whether or not my generation was apathetic. And I said, well, it didn't seem right to me that they're apathetic. I thought that what was different, that they didn't have the opportunity to participate, because if you look at the civil rights movement, if you look at women's rights movement, the anti-war movement, whatever you believe, they were all fueled by young people out of college, and young people as a whole were the leads in those movements. But when you look at politics today, it seems like a lot of young people are not involved, but the big issue for them is it takes money to get involved today, and politics is very subtle today. So the college kids don't have money. What they have is a lot of debt. So I started a foundation when I became a player to prove my professor wrong, that young people is not apathetic, that if you can find a foundation that focuses in and the influence of money in politics, we'll be able to shift the political landscape, because what you have is that people who have money tend to not advocate for the people who don't. And so if young people wanted to have a voice, what they had to do was to change the landscape and how we practice our democracy. So Democracy Matters was engaging college students to get involved in political causes and to just let their voices be heard in the political spectrum, because they have been the forgotten demographic. So we had college campuses. We had chapters on over 85 college campuses where we engage young people and we get them involved and we get them to form chapters and really talk to each other about the proliferation of money in politics. And, you know, that has been really great. Throughout my career, I've been able to do that. And then secondly, I started the Kerstin Lam Foundation several years before I retired. And that was mainly to use basketball as a way to teach young people about, you know, discipline, the need to stay in school, the need for the duality between sports and academics, nutrition, AIDS awareness in the Caribbean. So we've been doing camps in the Caribbean and here in the United States. And what we try to teach young people is that they have the power through education to transform where they're at in life and to take them to the next level, and that they have to take that seriously. And, you know, learning to take care of themselves and the body is imperative in having that life that you want, and to find the path and to find the next generation of leaders. So those two foundations have kind of formed, you know, what I have believe is a moral imperative for athletes and people in public life, which is to give back as much as you can to the next generation and help them find their true purpose.
What a tremendous role model you are, Donald. The ability to utilize your celebrity status and create these foundations, first of all, one, during your career, to show your academic knowledge, saying, hey, I really hit the books. And I'm sure the players on your team were like, wow, this guy's deep. He really enjoys academics and really sees about giving back, and it really helps in the specific things with college scholarships. When we talk about Kerosene Camp Lamp Foundation, what I see is specifically really helping children where they don't have those role models, right, in the Caribbean, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's important, if you think of here as well, mentorship is very important. And kids need to have people that they can model themselves against. And I'm not saying that everything that a person in the public life do is going to be good, but the kids have to understand that they can take the good from the people that they have as role models, and they can leave the things that they don't like. So it's about giving them like a guiding force, like a hand that says, you know, you can do this. I mean, coming from the Caribbean and an island of 600-plus people and making it to the United States and being one of 450 players in the world, it's an extraordinary journey, but they have to know that it is possible. You know, coming from the ghetto in the United States and getting a chance to go to college and potentially go into the next level, they have to know that they have everything within them to do it. The question is, they have to believe it, and also they have to, you know, continue to find and have people show them the path of how to get there. So I felt like, you know, this was important because I've been given a gift by two strangers. They give me an opportunity to transform my life, and it is imperative that we pass it back to the next generation and help show them that path as well.
When we're talking about Kerosene, how are you able to run the foundation when you are, especially in the United States, a lot of the time? What you have a great team with you, don't you, to keep it going?
Yeah, you have to. But we always we do a lot of stuff during the year there. But we always believe that it was important that the kids see me and interact with me. So every summer we go back with some NBA players, college players, and really try to really do a series of camps, bring tons of books, and really help rebuild libraries, and you know, teach about nutrition, AIDS education. So we go back every summer and really do a big kind of reunion for the camp, so that the kids are interacting with us, they're seeing us, and we're able to really take basketball as a way of doing this. So the kids come to basketball camp and they're going to leave with books, they're going to leave, you know, have an opportunity to eat, they're going to leave with gifts, and they're going to leave with you know, nutrition advice. They're going to learn about sports psychology. So we make it about, it's basketball, but it's truly about life. It's about really giving them the tools to be successful.
So when we're talking about other NBA players that have been working with you, who else is helping you out, especially on the camps?
Well, over the many, this is our 10th year, we've had many players from Eric Dampier, Courtney Lee, to Clifford Ray. We've had to Leon Poole. We've had a lot of great players who give up their time to go down there and help us and really spread the word and really teach kids. And they have been great teachers because they have an opportunity to teach eager kids about a sport that is very near and dear to us. So we have been truly supported, and we felt that it was important to bring college players as well So we brought in college players, female as well as male, because we do a co-ed camp because we wanted to teach the kids about really peer pressure and really also talking to each other, boys and girls alike, and really understanding that there is no boundaries or barriers to sports. It's about really learning and really trying to get to the next level.
Well, absolutely. And can you tell us some success stories in the last 10 years involving kerosene? Any success stories?
I would say for us is we were able to bring a group of kids here to the States and get them to go to Stanford. They have a chance to go to Google. They had a chance to go to Facebook. And, you know, just seeing how much of the worldview has opened up to the possibility of what's possible for them. So I'll give you an example. We brought seven kids up, and before we brought them out, we asked them, you know, how many of them wanted to go to college, and I think it was two of them thought that they wanted to go to college. And by the end of the three-week trip here in the States, all seven of them wanted to go to college.
That's great.
And it was a testament to the fact that they now know what was possible, and their eyes as they open up to the possibilities of their lives. And they were eager to go back and start studying for the SATs and start really understanding that it's not just about sports, it's about the balance between sports and academics. So we have many of those stories. We have kids that come back and say, you know, I've been playing overseas for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's because I went to your camp and you really made me believe that many things are possible. We have kids going to college here in the United States. So it's that been through the camp. So it's been amazing in that you really are seeing the transformation, and not all of the success are as big as that. Some of the success are simple, like the kids come back and they're teaching us, I learned this. I learned how to dribble, and I ate properly today, and I lost 10 pounds, and I lost 15 pounds. So those stories are smaller, but they're
all important.
It's changing lifestyle, yeah.
They're all important, and there is a definite connection between your first foundation and the second one, especially with involving the academics part of it. Would you agree with democracy and kerosene? Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think that college kids, they need to know that there are people that are listening to them, and they need to know that they have the power and to change the world in which they find themselves. If they don't like the political system, instead of running away from it, they can get involved in it and change it and bring better sanity to it, and really trying to get money out of it so that their interests and their desires are being taken care of. After all, they're the ones that are fighting the wars. They're the ones that are going to inherit this country at some point. So they have to be engaging it and push politicians to do what is right rather than what is political expedient.
Okay, so also tell us about really interesting thing involving your children's book you wrote. Why did you decide to write a children's book?
Well, I wanted to write a kid's book because I thought that as we go back home every year, the kids are getting younger and younger, and I'm getting older. So I thought it was important to, as a roadmap, really, to really teach the kids about success and really about dreaming and about, you know, no matter where you find yourself and no matter how terrible you are initially as a basketball player, that there is something that is possible for you through perseverance and hard work. So the kids' book, Too Tall for to Find This Game, it's about failing in many different sports and really trying to find the one that suits you and then really working from there. It's going to be, this is the first of a series, and the idea is to really continue to just say, it's okay to fail. It's okay to not be successful all the time. Pick yourself up, work a little harder, and you might find success down the line.
Okay, Adonel, where can we find information on you? First of all, for people who want to donate to the two foundations, can purchase the children's book, all the different places. Is it your website? Is that correct?
Yeah, you can definitely go to donaldfoyle.com. You can go to the Kerosene Lamp Foundation, and you can go to democracymatters.org. I mean, we have all our websites are there, and you can click through them and donaldfoyle.com. So, and you have twotallfoyle.com as well, where you can get the kids' book, as well as on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Wow, you're really keeping busy after basketball.
This is my retirement phase.
And I think it helped, especially, you know, going back, getting your degree and all these different things that I saw that you were in the front office for the Orlando Magic at a time. Are you still involved in the NBA at all, or are you really just specific? What else are you doing? Or is this seems like so much?
I took a, yeah, year, I took a year off from basketball, and I just finished a second book on why professional athletes go broke. And that should be coming out in about another week or two. And the idea is, I wanted to talk to players who have gone through the league and players that are there and say, you know, what are the challenges? Why do you see so many players go through financial hardships? And so we're getting ready to launch that book in the next week and a half. So that I think that is going to be consuming my time for a little bit.
Well, we're going to have to welcome you on Author's Corner show to talk about both of your books. So I'll definitely reach out to your publicist. It was a lot of fun talking to you and learning a lot about you, O'Donnell. Good luck on your ventures, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you so very much for really talking and listening to me.
All right. I enjoyed learning from you, so take care now.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right, you're listening to the Total Education Total Tutor Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Show on the Total Education Network. Again, remember to go to my website, TotalTutor.org, for more information. This is what's so exciting about the show. We have a celebrity drop in when I just least expect it. I want to welcome the program, Steven Jackson from the St. Louis Rams. Thanks again for calling the program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you specifically about the whole situation, what you're trying to do with your foundation. What a tremendous thing to give back to the community, especially with as a successful athlete as you are. Why did you decide to do that? What is your whole drive to do this?
I think just first and foremost, being able to play in the National Football League, we all have the impact of the positive influence in our communities and growing up in Las Vegas, Nevada. But we don't have a sports team. I wasn't fortunate enough to meet some of my idols and guys that I looked up to and wanted to be like. So once I mentioned the NFL, I wanted to be an outsource and be actually a symbol of hope to some of these young people to encourage them to live their lives, not only just because to achieve great success in athletics, but in their lives, period.
And you can make a difference because of your celebrity name and your success that you say, you know what, this is what is something that I'm called to do and I know I can help others. And that by having this name, let me utilize it, correct?
Well, it definitely allows you to reach out to people that know, you know, it would be harder to reach and they give you their ear a little easier. But a lot of people, no matter if you're famous or not, when they feel the sincerity of you wanting to help out, and they're very thankful for them and for you, people like us, to just think about them.
Definitely. Now, tell us about your foundation. You're doing some tremendous things, working with many different people in the St. Louis community and all over the world. But when it comes to your passion, how passionate you are about education, tell us a little bit about that.
Steven Jackson Foundation was founded in 2004, and it's combating illiteracy. We want to encourage our young people to stay in school, and I always have an emphasis on telling them that you can't put a price tag on your education. You never get too old to learn. So I really hone in on that and talk to them about achieving great success while they're in school and the years after.
You know how important literacy is. If they can't read, how are they going to be successful in life?
Absolutely. It's a whole other world out there, especially in books. And when you have the chance to talk to kids and explain to them that you don't have to be, you don't have to live by what other people speak into your life, that you can achieve dreams and live out dreams. And I always talk to them about that. From the age of 10 years old or even younger, I had a dream and aspiration of being an NFL football player, but also I had other dreams of being an architect and being an artist as well. And I talked to him about the importance about that and how I even was able to graduate with a 3.8 GPA. And, you know, I really don't like to hear when people talk about dumb jocks, because that's farther from the truth when it comes to myself and especially some other guys that I've had the fortune of meeting with and playing with as well.
So how do people, when they hear you talk, especially when you're talking to different children about literacy and you talk about how education is so important to you, I'm sure they really respond to that, knowing that you had other career aspirations, not just being a professional football player.
Yes, you know, once again, once you open up the door for conversation and then dialogue, your children especially, they have such great questions and interest, and we just feed off of that. I always come genuine. I don't come rehearsed. And my time with the kids and at the school is just second to none, and I really enjoy it. It's almost as good as, you know, scoring a touchdown sometimes.
Does your foundation reach out not just to education and other things as well?
Yeah, definitely. We reach out. I have something in December we call 39 Wishes, where I help give families in the St. Louis area Christmas that they wasn't expecting. But we surprised, and we were able to bless 3,000 families last year. Last week, I had a backpack drive, a going back to school drive in Las Vegas, Nevada, where we hand out to students free backpacks, food, drinks, and notebooks, and having them feel good and excited about having a fresh start at the school year. So throughout the whole year, we always have something coming up, and I love personally just being better in the community, and I always for them to feel like I'm in an olive branch not too far away.
Well, that's fantastic, Stephen. Where can we find more information on you, learn about your foundation and all the great things that you're doing in the community?
You can follow me at Twitter at sj39.com and on my website as well, www.sj39.com.
And 30 seconds, Stephen, what would you say, what advice would you offer kids out there, especially when they really don't enjoy reading?
I would always tell them to start with a subject that interests them. Once you get into a subject that interests you and you begin to read upon it, you don't think about the pages or how long or in depth the book is, but you draw really near and you find some more insight on that subject. And once you're able to gravitate towards that and realize reading is not as bad as you once thought it was, you begin to just soul searching, going to all different kinds of topics and subjects that you want to learn about.
Well, good luck in the upcoming season, and good luck on your charity and all the great things that you're doing. And I really appreciate you taking the time to call me today.
Thank you.
All right, take care, Stephen.